Commerce Committee to order at 3:18 p.m. On Monday, April 12th. All right, there we go. Members present are Vice Chair Schragi and Representatives McCarty, Snyder, and Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, thanks to our secretary today, Leah Frazier, and our LAO moderator, Alex Banizek, for joining us today. I want to remind yourself to speak into your microphones for those that are listening online, as well as for House Records staff working remotely. If you haven't already, now is a good time to silence your cell phones. We have four items on today's agenda, and it is our goal to end promptly at 5 p.m. I will just note for the committee members. First, we'll consider three of the governor's appointees we didn't get to at our last meeting on Wednesday. Second, we'll have an introductory hearing for SB 87, the governor's legislation on reinsurance. Third, we'll have a hearing on HB 145, Representative Snyder's bill, relating to pharmacists. And last, we'll have a second hearing and take final action on HB 90, Representative Wool's bill on vehicle rental networks. Are there any questions for members of the committee before we begin? All right, let me go and make sure we've got everybody online, our governors, our appointees. All right, that brings us to our first order of business. That's the governor's appointees. First up is Justin Ruffridge, appointee to the Board of Pharmacy, who's also going to testify a little bit later on Rep. Snyder's bill. Mr. Ruffridge, are you online?
I'm sorry. It kept on saying muted, unmuted. I assume I can be heard, correct?
We can hear you just fine. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your qualifications for an interest in serving on the board.
Thank you very much. And my name is Justin Ruffridge. I currently reside in Soldotna, Alaska, for the record. And through the chairs, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I certainly hope to earn your support for my confirmation to the Board of Pharmacy. A little bit about me. I've been in Alaska most of my life. I did have to travel outside of the state to attend Washington State University, where I graduated with a Doctor of Pharmacy degree in 2008. I did return immediately to the state to practice, and I've been practicing in Soldotna since then. I've been involved in a variety of areas of pharmacy practice, currently own three pharmacies in our state, here in Soldotna, one in Girdwood and one in Juneau. But I've also been involved in compounding, standard dispensing, ambulatory care, and medication management services. I've also had the opportunity to teach with both the UAA Pharmacy Technology Program and with the joint UAA-ISU Pharmacy School, which I could not be more excited about that being an opportunity in our state. I certainly hope to continue service to my community, not only through my profession, but also with this public service, especially given the huge amount of ownership in the healthcare field that pharmacists are being tasked with lately. And there's a lot of effort being done to ensure that that is being done safely and effectively. Happy to answer any questions you might have, and thank you for this chance.
All right, thank you. And I want to just recognize that Representatives Kaufman and Nelson joined us at 3:20 p.m. And I have to say, Mr. Ruffridge, there is no shame in going to Washington State University. It's an excellent institution. One of my brothers is on the faculty there, and we're glad that you came back home. All right, are there any questions for Mr. Ruffridge? Representative McCarty.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, the pharmacy industry has gone through a number of different scrutinizing with the opiate issues and such, and I know that that's not the issue for you and your pharmacies, but what are some concerns that you have for pharmacies in Alaska today?
That's a great question, and through the chair to Representative McCarty, it's an ever-present issue throughout the state. I think pharmacists, particularly the Board of Pharmacy, has been a partner in combating the opioid epidemic. I think pharmacists are a natural choice to help progress down a path of health for Alaskans. we are the natural, you know, protector of the medicine, to be honest with you. I think, and historically, pharmacists have felt a little bit stuck between a rock and a hard place. You have a patient that wants something and a doctor who's prescribed it, and uncertain of what their abilities and duties are to some degree. I think our board, specifically in this state, has gone to great lengths to ensure that pharmacists know what their duties are, one, and what their protections are, two, particularly when it comes to questioning whether or not the fills of opiate medications are appropriate. That being said, I've seen in 12 years of practice in the state a significant alteration of prescribing practices and durations of therapy, all sorts of things. I think we're headed in the right direction and proud to say we've been a part of that.
Paula?
Yes, just the follow-up is thank you for doing those very things. And questions like, what can be done or has been done in collaboration with the Board of Medicine as well as pharmacy?
Yeah, another great question, and through the chair to Representative McCarty, the honestly, that process is ongoing. We actually just had a joint Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine meeting at our last scheduled time. It took a half hour to discuss the prescription drug monitoring program, ways that physicians and prescribers can collaborate with pharmacists to, you know, produce high-quality health care. And there remains to be just a huge amount of effort that's needed to progress down that pathway. And once again, those bridges are being made. I will say that our current chair of the Board of Pharmacy, Rich Holt, has gone above and beyond to make those connections happen. But I would hope to progress that connection as well. But that is being done.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Ruffage? All right. I don't have any questions, but I do just want to thank you. I do believe that you've been, a leader in trying to, move change as it relates to prescribing in the state of Alaska, and that you testified against a physician who was essentially running a pill mill in the state of Alaska. And it does take sort of, we've got the system that we have now put in place that has this, you know, these checks and balances. But I just personally appreciate your leadership in that very much. All right.
Thank you.
Next up, we're going to go to Dr. Bernhardt, an appointee to the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Dr. Bernhardt?
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Great. Thank you. So for the record, my name is Dr. Rachel Bernhardt. And although you have my resume in front of you, I'll provide you just a brief summary of my past work with the Board of Veterinary Examiners, along with a few additional updates since my resume was submitted to you. I've lived and worked in Alaska since 2002. Like many, I came here for a three-month job. I found my forever home. I've been fortunate enough to work in Alaska in locations as diverse as Upiavik, all the way to Prince of Wales and many places in between. I'm currently based out of Juneau. One notable accomplishment that has occurred since that resume was filed with you is that I graduated magna cum laude from Seattle University School of Law with my JD in May of 2020. I then became a licensed member of the Alaska Bar in November of 2020. So I was initially confirmed to the Board of Veterinary Examiners in March of 2016. I'm before you today seeking legislative reinstatement to continue my work with the board. As we navigate this current pandemic, the need for veterinary access is paramount for reasons ranging from recognizing the role veterinarians play in zoonotic disease risk management, particularly since COVID may have animal origins, as well as that to increase need for veterinary services due to pandemic pet adoptions and everything in between. Last year, I worked with the board focusing on meeting the needs of the public's safe access to veterinary care during the pandemic by providing best practices and guidance to licensees for continued provision of veterinary services, as well as with COVID-related emergency regulations and ongoing monitoring of state mandates and how that affected the public and access to veterinary care. I participated in legislative testimony and outreach regarding bills related to the practice of veterinary medicine. I've partnered with other healthcare professional boards relating to COVID and to the prescription drug related topics. I represented the Board of Veterinary Examiners at veterinary meetings for the Interior Veterinary Medical Association and the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association to provide updates to licensees regarding the board's activities. I also attend the Association of American Veterinary State Boards annual meetings, as well as I'm an active member of the Regulatory Policy Task Force Committee, which is a collaborative effort to provide guidance to state boards regarding emerging veterinary regulatory issues. I've established lines of communication with the new DEA agent based out of Anchorage and relayed that information to the board and licensees that arose from our communications. I've been available to provide testimony at local assembly meetings throughout the state on topics of ordinance changes that involve the practice of veterinary medicine. I've also acted as an initial board member review for cases brought forward by state investigators. I'd like to continue my work with the board in order to keep momentum going on regulations review and necessary updates, particularly as it relates to regulations involving the VCPR, which is an ongoing project that has received widespread public comment and is the very backbone of the legal relationship between the vets, the animals they care for, and their owners, as well as current regulations projects involving telehealth services, and to continue working towards addressing the ease of appropriate licensure to make sure Alaska is a welcoming place that attracts new and existing veterinarians. Furthermore, the board has been working with other regulators regarding the prescription drug monitoring program, and we fully support HB 91, which was introduced by Representative Wool. Veterinarians acknowledge the opiate crisis occurring in our state and country, and as regulators, it's our job to promote regulations and best practices that appropriately address veterinarians' roles. The PDMP is simply not that. Veterinarians nationally prescribe less than 0.3% of all prescribed opiates, and the data from Alaska is comparable with that nationally. Total investigative expenditures by the board are over $40,000 in the first half of fiscal year 21, which puts the board on track to more than double investigative expenditures from FY 20 to over $80,000. At our January board meeting, state investigators reported that there were 56 open veterinary cases related to using the PDMP, none of which appear to have any relation to illicit prescribing, rather an inability to use a non-usable system. Our usual number of open investigations is generally in the single digits. Investigations are paid for by the board, which is funded solely by licensees. Alaska already has one of the most expensive veterinary licenses in the country, and costs are expected to rise again due to increased expenditures. What's important to remember is that zero cases of veterinary drug diversion have been identified through this program. Equally important to remember is that veterinary drug shopping has not been identified as having a measurable impact on the opiate epidemic, as the small quantities prescribed and upfront payment required essentially preclude veterinarians as a conduit in the manner that the PDMP is purporting to address. Additionally, drugs prescribed in veterinary medicine are not those commonly associated with opiate deaths. It has been brought up in this very committee that simply retooling the PDMP would fix the problem. The problem is more than just the APRIS PDMP database. There is simply no program that interfaces with veterinary records, which are not standardized across the veterinary profession, contrary to human health programs, which have uniformity due to federal funding, insurance programs.
Dr. Berngart?
Yes.
Can I ask you to wrap up your comments?
Absolutely. Exempting the veterinarians from the PDMP does not mean veterinarians are left unchecked or that valuable data is lost. Veterinarians would continue to be monitored through the DEA, veterinary distribution companies, and through pharmacies where veterinarians prescribe. While veterinarians do write prescriptions for animals, this PDMP prescription is simply the wrong one for animals and people we serve, as well as for veterinarians. So with that, I'm asking for your support for reconfirmation, and I'm available to answer any additional questions you may have.
All right. Rep. Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Dr. Berngart, I totally understand where you're coming from on Representative Wool's bill, and I'm glad to have your intake on that right now, and then possibly in the future when that comes up in front of us, whenever it does. But I would love to get to know about your resume a little bit more in depth than wanting to hear about Representative Wool's bill. It's hopefully going to come up in front of us. Can you talk a little bit about your time as a veterinarian and why you want to be on stay on this board?
Sure thing. Thank you for the question. So through the chair, a little bit more about my resume personally. I have served in private nonprofit organizations as the clinical director of the Humane Society here in Juneau for 10 years. I've also been involved in marine mammal science efforts. I've worked for the Alaska Sea Life Center. I've traveled internationally to work within the United States Antarctic Program with Alaska. They were from University of Alaska Anchorage researchers, and we did work for over seven seasons on the Weddell seal. So I've also been a private business owner, provided equine care to residents of Southeast Alaska. I've traveled in boats, planes, helicopters, you name it, to go see different equine critters. And I also do regular dog and cat small animal medicine here in Juneau as well. So essentially, I've got public sector, private nonprofit experience, and I've worked in a wide variety of locations throughout Alaska in my almost 20 years of being here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Berngart. You know, one of the big things that stood out to me was the Antarctic research. That's probably the biggest thing I've seen in all the resumes so far that's jumped out to me. That's quite a resume you have, and I'm excited to hear more about it. But thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other questions? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your time today. All right, next up we're going to go to May Hayes, appointee to the Board of Real Estate Appraisers. Ms. Hayes, are you online?
I am.
All right, introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your qualifications and interest in serving on the board.
Hi, my name is May Hayes. I'm a certified real estate appraiser. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, went to Osceola High School. I got my real estate license at 19, and so I've been in the real estate industry for about 20 years. 12 years ago, I became a certified real estate appraiser. My husband's a general contractor, and I'm an operating principal in that company as well. So I've been working in new construction for about 15 years. I'd like to serve on the board to become more knowledgeable and understanding the issues surrounding my field outside of just continuing education classes. The community of appraisers is not similar to real estate brokers and licensees, and that most of us appraisers work alone for most of our careers. And because of this, the information that we have about each other's professional lives is, and how others practice real estate valuation is limited. I'd like to gain an understanding of the challenges of my peers, and I'm also curious how consumers are impacted by my profession outside of what I hear in continuing education classes. I think the value of having me on the board is that I have a perspective on the other fields within the real estate industry that my appraisal peers don't have. I believe that appraisals are critical to keep economies healthy, and that my other roles in real estate will be of value to the board when dealing with this symbiotic profession. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Hayes? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on these appointees. Is there anybody online for public testimony? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony then. All right, next up on our agenda is an introductory hearing for SB 87, the governor's bill on reinsurance. Today with us is Lori Wing-Hire, director of the Division of Insurance. Can you go ahead and put yourself on the record and introduce the legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lori Wing-Hire, and I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state. I thank you for taking the time to listen to me talk a little bit about SB 87 today. Insurance is very complicated, and one of the most important things we do is monitor solvency, because it's not going to help your consumers or your constituents if in the end there's not money to pay the claims. And that doesn't matter if it's health insurance or your homeowners or an auto insurance policy. But in reality, the insurance company that you buy your insurance from probably only keeps a portion of the risk. In other words, if you have a home that's worth, let's say, $500,000, mm-hmm. there's a chance that that insurance company maybe insures $250,000 of it, and they buy reinsurance behind it. And they would, so you would never know this, but I know this as a regulator, that they keep $250,000 and they transfer $250,000 to a reinsurer. Or maybe they just transfer the earthquake portion of your policy because they don't want to be on the line for earthquake. Mm-hmm. So back in 2008, when the markets all fell apart, we as regulators and as insurance people realized that we monitored the solvency of our insurance companies very well, but we didn't monitor reinsurance very well. So the United States, along with the European Union and the United Kingdom, developed what we call the covered agreement. And it's a very detailed agreement that's basically providing reciprocity, that the companies in Europe and in the UK will hold their insurance companies to the same financial standards that I do as a US regulator. The agreement, the covered agreement with the European Union, was signed by President Obama. The covered agreement with the United Kingdom was signed by President Trump. But as we continue to watch international insurers, we see every now and then there's a need for a modification, and that's what this bill does. It's a rather lengthy bill, but you don't see a change in it till you get to page 10. And on page 10, you're going to see that we have amended the conditions for qualified reinsurer, what they must meet to assume liabilities of a domestic insurer. Our domestic insurers would be Alaska National Insurance Company and Umalik Insurance Company. Those are the two that this would most apply for.
What was the second one?
Umalik, U-M-I-A-L-I-K. So why do we call it credit for reinsurance? Because on the financials that I'm monitoring for the insurance company for solvency, if they buy reinsurance from a qualified reinsurer, I can give them a credit. In other words, going back to that $500,000 home, they may not have to hold the whole $500,000 as a surplus or as capital to pay your claim. I would give them a credit for what they bought in reinsurance, provided it's qualified from one of these jurisdictions. And that, in essence, is what this bill is doing. We are, as you can see, I think on the sectional, that a qualified reinsurer to assume the liabilities of a domestic insurer has to have its head office or be domiciled in a reciprocal jurisdiction, have and maintain certain capital and surplus ratios, have minimum solvency and capital ratios that we would agree to, agree to provide us prompt notification for information that we would ask for regarding their solvency, paying judgments in a timely manner if there were to be one, provide documentation that we may ask as a result of an examination, maintain or confirm to us on an annual basis that they're complying with the requirements of this bill, and agree that nothing precludes them from an assuming insurer from providing the director, which in this case would be me, with the information we ask for. Finally, the bill provides a definition for a reciprocal jurisdiction, which again is going to be the countries in the European Union, the United Kingdom, the Commonwealth, including Bermuda. And that, in essence, it's a long bill, but that's a short summary of why this bill is before you, why it's important, and why we're asking for your support on it. And Madam Chair, I'm happy to take any questions on this bill.
All right. Are there any questions for you? All right. Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sponholz. Ms. Winghire, it seems like to the extent that reinsurance is more broadly available for people, it would tend to disproportionately benefit people in regions with low-frequency, high-consequence events like earthquakes. Is that kind of a reasonable intuition?
Through the Chair, that is exactly what the reinsurance is for. I mean, you're looking at your higher risk perils where it's not low frequency or it's not high frequency, but when it happens, it's catastrophic.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, thank you very much. Okay, so this is our introductory hearing for SB 87. We're gonna hold the bill and bring it up at a later date. Amendments for SB 87 are due on Friday, April 16th by 5 p.m. All right, next up we're going to go to an introductory hearing for HB 145, Representative Snyder's bill relating to pharmacists. And we're going to have an introductory remarks from Representative Snyder. We're going to hear a sectional analysis, and then we're going to move to invited testimony, and then we will take questions in that order. All right? So hold your questions.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz.
So with House Bill 145, expand pharmacist authority, in essence, much of this could be characterized as a housekeeping bill as it pertains to the business of pharmacy and the services that pharmacists and their associated co-workers provide. Also titled the Pharmacist Mobilization Act, we are aiming to increase access to care and to ensure that our pharmacists here in Alaska are reimbursed for providing services, many of these services of which we're already pretty intimately familiar as consumers in Alaska. I'm introducing it at the request of the Alaska Pharmacists Association in partnership with the Alaska Board of Pharmacy and the University of Alaska and Idaho State Doctor of Pharmacy Program, I don't know if joint is the officially correct word using academic parlance, but it is delivered together at the UAA campus. As we've seen in some other legislation resulting from or informed by the pandemic, where we've seen some of the adaptations that we made or some relaxation of regulations that we made to best respond. We've seen that in telehealth. We wanted to continue some of those services that we can provide. We've seen some reductions in rules regarding board meetings online and those types of things. This is a similar result here in the realm of pharmacy. We've seen that pharmacists have provided COVID-19 testing, vaccinations, telehealth visits. They've helped manage patients or help patients manage chronic health conditions, and this bill will update outdated statute to help them continue providing some of these services. It defines the patient care services that pharmacists and pharmacy staff, their support staff, can independently provide. It allows pharmacist technicians to administer vaccines when under direct supervision of a licensed pharmacist. And it empowers the Board of Pharmacy to regulate pharmacists, student pharmacists, and pharmacy support staff who provide these services. Also worth noting that it updates the current provider anti-discrimination statute, so adding pharmacists into the list of healthcare providers. And in summary, its passage will benefit Alaskans by increasing healthcare access, both during, as we continue to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, and following the pandemic. And I will look to the co-chair, and so we'll introduce the, or walk through the sectional when you're ready.
Walk through the sectional.
For the record, Aliana Salingi, Chief of Staff to Representative Snyder. Section 1 for HB 145 adds language allowing the Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules to regulate the independent monitoring of drug therapy and prescribing of vaccines and naloxone by pharmacists. This is within their professional scope and already done. Once again, this language just updates statute, so it is currently, or so it's in line with current practice. Section 2 adds language allowing pharmacists to recommend non-prescription medication and devices for treating minor and self-limited conditions. This looks like when you go to the pharmacist and ask for recommendation for headaches or treatment for headaches, joint pain, rashes, or recommendations for a blood pressure monitor or blood sugar monitor. Section 3 increases the Board of Pharmacy's flexibility to grant emergency licenses for relevant licenses used in pharmacies. Section 4 updates the vaccine administration statute by adding prescribe to it. Currently, it says independently administer instead of prescribe. This cleans that up. Section 5 also cleans up the language by replacing dispense with prescribe and administer in regards to administering an opioid overdose drug such as naloxone. Section 6 allows a pharmacy technician to administer a vaccine or related emergency medication, but only if they have been authorized by the Board of Pharmacy and are working under the direct supervision of a licensed pharmacist that meets statutory requirements. Section 7, if asked by a customer, allows employees to disclose the cost of filling a script. Currently, only pharmacists are allowed to do that. Section 8 is a little complicated. Pharmacists currently provide a variety of patient care services, and this section adds language for when a pharmacist would need to enter into a written and approved agreement with a practitioner to provide care and for when a pharmacist could act independently. So care under an agreement with a practitioner would be limited to care for an existing diagnosis. However, care provided independently by a pharmacist would be care for minor or self-limiting things or things covered under a CLIA waiver, so a clinical laboratory improvement amendment, so tests like COVID-19 that can be done at home or tests to see if you have the flu. Section 9 amends AS08-8480 by removing dosage form as a definition of equivalent drug product. In practice, this looks like a pharmacist changing the form of a certain medication. So if somebody were prescribed a painkiller and it was in tablet form, however, the pharmacist was out of stock of that form or the individual couldn't take the pill, the pharmacist could change it to be a cough syrup. These changes are limited to non-therapeutic changes. And Section 10 is just conforming language, and Section 11, as Representative Snyder said, adds pharmacists to the unfair discrimination statute.
All right, thank you very much. And I believe that for invited testimony, we have Gretchen Glaspy, Tom Wadsworth, and then for questions, we have Justin Ruffridge. Is there anybody else you're expecting? We also have Laura Carrillo or Carrillo online with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Oh. Sarah Chambers with DCCED as well.
Yes, for questions.
All right. Erin Narcis, a lead pharmacist with the Division of Healthcare Services, and Coleman Cutchins with the Department of Health and Social Services as well. So we've got a bunch of resources in case we need any lifelines here. All right. Is there any order you'd like to proceed with the invited testimony?
Yeah, I think Dr. Wadsworth would be a smart start.
All right. We will start with Dr. Wadsworth, and then we will go to Gretchen Glatzby.
Okay, thank you. Unmuted now. Through the chair, I have to qualify my statements first. I'm with the UAA ISU Doctor of Pharmacy program. I'm the chief administrative officer for this collaborative program here in Anchorage, and my testimony does not represent any official position or opinion of UA. My remarks are my own opinion, and I speak as a practicing pharmacist of 19 years and also as an educator of the Doctor of Pharmacy students here in the state. So, you know, we of course are supporting this bill. We've been involved in advising the association and also the Board of Pharmacy in updating these practices. Our program trains our Doctor of Pharmacy students in all of the things that you'll find in this bill. This is a professional doctorate program. These are doctors upon graduation, and these are folks that we want to engage at a high level in healthcare in a variety of patient care settings. You're probably more accustomed dealing with pharmacists in the community sector, so that's your Walgreens, Safeway, even Soldotna Pharmacy there in Kenai. But pharmacists actually, more than half of all pharmacists practice outside of the community setting. These regulatory changes or statute changes to empower the board to promulgate regulation is needed to update to what pharmacists have been doing for three decades in these sectors. That's primary care pharmacy. These are pharmacists that are embedded inside of physician clinics. They don't do dispensing. They do med management. They do post-diagnostic disease management. What that means is they're helping you with your medication so you have a good experience with them before they're dispensed to you and even after. We have pharmacists who specialize in every healthcare sector: pediatric pharmacists, oncology pharmacists, infectious disease pharmacists, psychiatric pharmacists, all medication experts there to improve the medication experience for the patient. So we view this as a needed update to our pharmacy practice laws and empower the Board of Pharmacy to regulate those types of pharmacies, these patient care services that aren't related to dispensing. I think I'll stop there with my comments and then let Gretchen speak, just to be brief.
Gretchen Glaspy.
Thank you very much for having us today. I am the elected president of the Alaska Pharmacists Association, which represents over 250 pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, and student pharmacists across the state of Alaska. We appreciate Representative Snyder for sponsoring this bill and all of our other co-sponsors, and we very much hope for support for this bill in moving along and matching the practice of pharmacy it exists now. I have been a pharmacist for 15 years, the last 7.5 in the state of Alaska. I am at Bartlett Regional here in Juneau and carry the interesting title of clinical informatics pharmacist, which means that I'm behind the scenes building the order sets and making them work for the doctors, in addition to all the other med management for the various systems for the hospital. And I thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And then I think next up we have Justin Ruffridge again with the State Board of Pharmacy.
Hello, everyone. Thank you again for hearing us today. From Tom and Gretchen, I just want to say I echo the things that they've said already. Just from my perspective, from the board's position, the last year has been, as I'm sure for everyone, an entertaining entertaining life. The Board of Pharmacy was tasked with regulating and attempting to promote regulations to support our COVID response and have those emergency regulations also take effect post-pandemic for recovery and expanding access to healthcare. One of the most difficult portions of that those efforts was our consistent run up against our state statute not matching what our practice of pharmacy is today. Our current statute, in a lot of senses, is only for the dispensing pharmacist, the pharmacist of old, basically. And those still exist, as Tom has already said, but many pharmacists like Gretchen and others in the state are not well represented by our current statute, and our regulations are incapable of matching that without statute change. So from the board perspective, this empowers the board to continue to regulate pharmacy and pharmacists, pharmacy technicians and interns at the highest level possible. Without statute changes, some of those things are really handcuffed for the Board of Pharmacy's position, and statute changes is needed. And certainly happy to answer any questions to that effect.
All right, thank you very much. So that, I believe that that covers our invited testimony. Are there any questions for the bill's sponsor or any of our invited testifiers today? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, for the bill sponsor or for anyone that could help me understand this a little bit more, specifically to Section 7 of the bill, just looking at disclosure of prices for filling a prescription, I feel like that would be more in the pharmacist's wheel well instead of just someone acting at the discretion of the pharmacist. The pharmacist would be more inclined to know and have knowledge on that. I just want to get some better understanding and hear from someone on that.
Do you want to answer this, or do we want to volley this to a professional?
I'd like to volley this to a professional pharmacist, yes.
All right. Mr. Ruffridge?
Justin.
You've been nominated. Mr. Ruffridge.
Yeah, I thank you. Through the chair, that's an excellent question. I actually think that in current practice, there's a wide variety of opportunity here for multiple individuals to use that information. Frankly, what we do in most pharmacies is the pharmacist position is a relatively small position by personnel numbers. So you might have one or two pharmacists working in a pharmacy, and you might have four or five technicians. Now, these technicians are usually highly trained. As I spoke earlier, I teach for a pharmacy technology program with UAA. So in a lot of senses, they have a year's worth of education and an occupational endorsement certificate. And they're actually the ones that are usually engaged in that more computer-based activity, billing prescriptions, looking up prices, ordering medications. The pharmacist is really the clinical director of that operation. So anything that's med-related, interactions, side effects, things of that nature is really where we want pharmacists spending their time. Pharmacy technicians are frankly probably more adept and more in the nitty-gritty of the billing than the pharmacist is on a day-to-day basis. And so that's a great example of one that we want to align more closely with our current practices.
Excellent answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I think when you go to the pharmacy, most of the time you don't actually speak with a pharmacist. You speak with the pharmacy tech, who's the person who gets your prescription, brings it to you, lets you know what the price is going to be, and they do the lookup in the database to find out what your actual copay will be based on your insurance. So it's a good question. Any other questions? All right, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to the sponsor, or as delegated to our distinguished panel. I bounced this off of some physicians, and I got some feedback that with respect to page 4, starting at 3, there was some concern that maybe this got a little bit into primary care. The language limits at first, but then it just felt to them that it maybe was opening the door a little bit too much. And I don't have an answer on this for myself, but just wonder if we could bounce that around a little bit, just get a little bit more thought on it and see if we need to do anything. Thank you.
I would like to turn to Dr. Wadsworth, but I did want to mention, I think it's an partial answer to that concern, and right, we talked about it, and I think it's a good question. We have not to date received any contact from concerned physicians or physicians groups. And we have reached out and are interested in continuing that conversation, but to date we have not been contacted with any concerns. But Dr. Wadsworth can address the day-to-day.
Dr. Wadsworth?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the question. And through the chair, I'll answer as best I can. I believe you're referring to Section 8. Is that correct? Just to make sure I'm on the right page.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, Section 8, in current statute, there's a definition for pharmaceutical care already that talks about the duties of a pharmacist to provide pharmaceutical care or drug therapy and what is called other patient care services for the intent of cure, prevention, and treatment of disease. That's pretty standard language inside statute about medical treatment, that cure, prevention, and treatment of disease. And our attempt here in Section 8 is to clearly define what patient care services that refers to. There's nothing in this section that pharmacists have not been doing for at least 2 or 3 decades. It's primarily been limited to the tribal organizations or the VA because in the private sector, pharmacists have had a difficult time engaging health plans for reimbursement of those services. And of course, as you know, in a free market, when services aren't reimbursed or there's not a sufficient revenue stream, then services just aren't offered. So in Section 8, we've tried to spell out what patient care services pharmacists have been doing. And you'll see here the first section, this collaborative agreement, providing patient care services in collaboration with the practitioner. This is in accord with already existing statute and regulation around what we call the pharmacist collaborative authority that's been in effect since 2002. Many of the pharmacists, in fact, many of them here on this call or that have worked on this bill have been providing those services for a very long time inside tribal organizations or even inside private practice or in the community sector. The second part of Section 8 tries to clarify so if there are things that a pharmacist must collaborate with a practitioner, what are those patient care services that a pharmacist may do independently? And there's nothing listed here that pharmacists don't already do. So you look here about general health and wellness. You think about smoking cessation, over-the-counter recommendations for a rash or for a headache that were brought up. Disease prevention, that's where vaccines lie. Or referring somebody about bone health and how much calcium or vitamin D should be taken. Those are non-prescriptive products. And you look at number 3, we're talking about minor or self-limiting illnesses, so conditions that are minor or generally self-limiting. Again, those are things that present to pharmacists that they have been doing independently for many years. Athlete's foot, yeast infections,
things that present in the community. And then you look at CLIA-waived tests. COVID-19 is a really good example of that because we've recently been doing these CLIA-waived point-of-care tests, but there are many CLIA-waived point-of-care tests, and in order to do a CLIA-waived point-of-care test, you simply just have to have a CLIA waiver, which is a simple application through the state. You pay a fee, and anyone can do these services. If this bill were to not pass, these practices would still continue under the current statute. They're not just given, the current statute just doesn't give this specific clarity, which we're hoping to have inside the statute so the Board of Pharmacy can specifically regulate those, but also so that we can have pharmacists engage health plans so that they can do this in the private sector and broaden access to these kinds of general health and wellness and disease prevention treatments or patient services. We don't believe this language, and our intent is not to expand authority as it pertains to prescriptive authority or prescribing as a result of any of these services. If a pharmacist wants to prescribe, and right now pharmacists do prescribe medications, they do so three ways. One, the statute that you've seen here in the bill, actually pharmacists have been prescribing vaccines since 2015. Mm-hmm. Pharmacists, because of that, have been able to increase vaccination rates and by and large give a bulk of the vaccines every year, and any vaccine really. And then naloxone, which we want to have availability. Pharmacists can prescribe naloxone. And then the third is pharmacists can prescribe if they have a collaborative practice authority agreement. That's that law from 2002 that we have in regulation that allows pharmacists to prescribe underneath those. So they're doing so with a prescribing provider. That would be a physician or a nurse practitioner or even a PA. Those collaborative agreements are reviewed by the board already and also the Board of Medicine already. And they're spelled out quite well. We believe that's a good regulation, but we need some clarity on independent patient care services so that we can engage with health plans to provide those. And COVID-19 really showed us that. Rather than having to charge a patient cash for coming to Soldotna Pharmacy to get a point of care test for COVID, this specifically, the pharmacist can point to inside their scope of practice. The Board of Pharmacy can regulate two health plans to say, no, these things are in our scope of practice and we would like to enroll in your health plan for those covered services for your patient. I think that gets at it. I'll stop there.
Do you have a follow-up?
Sure. Yes, please. Thank you. Through the chair, and thank you for that. I guess when I look at it, having been brought to my attention, I just wonder, so at line 3, B, a pharmacist may independently provide patient care services for general health and wellness. The only thing, having had that brought to my attention, I wonder, okay, what are the limits on that? Just to avoid having a future interpretive problem with it where somebody feels greatly enabled by that, I just wonder if that maybe could lead somebody to think they have more authority than they do, or for disease prevention. Those are pretty broad, and I haven't been able to think of another way to say it, but I think what we're up against, there's kind of the standard understanding, but it's not defined. And I think the question that was being brought to my attention is that well enough defined just prevent somebody from getting crossed up?
And do we want to volley this one over to Justin Ruffridge with the board?
Yes, I think that would be a good direction to go.
Thank you, through the chair. This is an excellent question, one that we've actually spent a considerable amount of time and effort discussing with providers, with multiple physicians and other practitioners across the state. And I think the intent here, as Tom very eloquently put, is clear to a pharmacist. I think you have to have a little bit of understanding of a pharmacist practice in general to sort of know that prescribing is not really our goal, and nor is it the goal of the Board of Pharmacy to promote prescribing outside of the current items that Tom has already mentioned that we're allowed to prescribe. One of the things in engaging with the Department of Law recently through the Board of Pharmacy is we were informed that because our current statute limits prescribing to the items already mentioned in statute, that by default, all other prescribing, since it's mentioned already in the collaborative practice agreement language, must go through a collaborative practice agreement. Even if the board wanted to regulate and say that all pharmacists could prescribe smoking cessation therapy, for example, we cannot do that because it's not in statute. So as Tom is mentioning, this is very important to understand that framework that the board has been coming from. I agree the language is somewhat vague. However, the vagueness there does allow the multitude of situations facing pharmacists every day where somebody comes in to ask that question, what is this? How do I look at it? What do you have available to me? That is something that we build our framework around statutorily and that the Board of Pharmacy can then regulate. This is by no means a direct attack on prescribing, nor is it trying to have pharmacists then prescribe outside of the collaborative practice agreement. And I think that a legal opinion would support that, and it's certainly one that the board has sought out as well. And that is the answer we've received.
And maybe we could get that just as a little bit of, you know, extra diligence, not antagonistic to the bill by any means, but just thank you.
More a comment.
Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sponholz. Yeah, I had the same question as Representative Kaufman, and it was kind of interesting to see the letters from ASHNA, from Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation, and from Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center that really put this bill in a broader context of care from a variety of providers. And I guess I read those as suggesting that the bill did strike the right balance, because definitely wondered the same thing when I first saw it. Thank you.
All right. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, I really appreciate the work that you guys are all doctors of medicine and in the healthcare profession myself. It's nice to defer to the pharmacist to inquire of different things and share the similar concerns and hearing that from different entities in the medical field of how much latitude is given to the pharmacist. But with that language there, I also am encouraged because you can find pharmacies almost anywhere, just like you can find post offices almost everywhere. And as the state is looking, not definitively decided yet, but to do away with some DMV offices, the question is like, well, what do you do about eye exams? And I shared, well, give the pharmacist the ability to do the eye exam. People go down there and just look in the little machine, and with this, I'm hearing from the pharmacies that, yes, we could do that. It's not an issue, and so it's nice that you exist, and I think making this language maybe a little cleaner, but yet the intent there is to provide a good service overall in the pharmacy, so thank you.
And just as a point of clarification, I believe that our testifiers are doctors of pharmacy and not doctors of medicine, just as a clarification. Representative McCarty's question actually piqued my piqued my interest. Are you actually proposing to do eye exams under this? It does seem to me a little bit outside of the scope of pharmacist training to do an eye exam, so I'm just trying to understand what's being proposed or what would, in fact, be allowed in with this law.
Madam Chair, are you asking me or one of our?
I think I want to hear from one of the pharmacists. Somebody can raise their hand and respond.
We weren't specifically, so through the chair, we weren't specifically proposing eye exams, although if you think about the training at DMV and the person giving the eye exam there, it certainly is not above purview to have a eye chart and the appropriate you know, policies in place to do an eye exam. There's nothing stopping a pharmacy now from doing that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's sort of just as a clarification, we're not talking about a full eye exam and a prescripting authority. Mm-hmm. We're talking about administering a test that's currently administered by folks who are already not trained in healthcare or optometry or ophthalmology, just as a clarification, right?
Yeah, I agree through the chair. An additional comment on that, too, is you'll note there's a precedent for every single one of these items that's in Section 8. And one of the reasons of having it in statute is for the board to adequately regulate that so that there isn't overreach. We view the board as the regulator of the statute. We just have to empower them to actually comment. It was actually a possible way of of going with this rather than putting in a statute is have the board promulgate regulation to define patient care services. But when we went that route, we found that the board lacks statutory authority to make such a designation. An example of rather than eye exams, although that's a possibility, more example that's actually happening now is perhaps diabetes screening or screening for high blood pressure. Those things don't require, some require a point of care test. Others require just a simple blood pressure reading. Those are the general health and wellness and disease prevention items that we're talking about.
All right. And I certainly have appreciated being able to get my flu shots at my pharmacy when I go there to pick up my regular prescriptions rather than having to go to a separate spot. Any other questions for the bill's sponsor or any of our invited testifiers? All right. Representative Snyder, would you like to make any closing comments today?
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. Just to echo something that, in retrospect, I wish I had emphasized more in my introduction, and I was very grateful to hear it brought up from our invited testimony, that this is really focused on updating our statute to reflect current modern practices in pharmacy. And thank you for your consideration and thoughtful questions.
All right, thank you very much. That wraps up our introductory hearing today. We're going to set this bill aside for now. Amendments, we're going to bring it back up on Friday, April 16th, and amendments to HB 145 are due by Thursday, April 15th at 8 a.m. So that brings us up to the last item on our agenda, and that is a second hearing and final action on HB 90. We received no amendments to this bill. So we will have some public testimony, final questions, and comments. You want to make any comments, Representative Wall?
Thank you. For the record, Representative Adam Wall, District 5, Fairbanks. I'd like to thank the committee and the co-chairs for hearing this bill again. I don't really have any final comments, but I'm happy to take any more questions.
All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, we had a response from Commissioner Mahoney, mm-hmm. the Department of Revenue, about the statements that were made on August 9th. I was hoping that you could address some of those about what the Department of Revenue's thoughts were on this bill.
And just before you do that, I just want to reference also that we have Mike Barnhill, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue online, as well as Nicole Reynolds, the Deputy Director of Tax Division with the Department of Revenue online, in case you need a lifeline.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe the Department of Revenue has taken a neutral position on the bill, and I think the statements that we presented before were from a previous administration, so I'm sorry for that bit of confusion. I think the letter also stated they will continue to follow the law as far as enforcing vehicle rental tax. And what was stated in the last committee meeting was that technically anyone renting a vehicle to anyone else in the state of Alaska is liable and owes a vehicle rental tax, although there's not a way to find out who all those people are, so it's hard to track them down, and that's why I feel this bill is important.
Paula.
Paula.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with that. Just next time with the PowerPoint and with the quote, it made it seem that the Department of Revenue was supporting this. And so maybe just have a little bit more of a follow-on or a little bit more of an in-depth brief. Because looking at what the Department of Revenue say, you know, all the way back in June 2018, it didn't seem like looking at the PowerPoint, that's what it was from. But, you know, to each their own, and we'll move forward from this.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We did have materials from our previous presentation from years past. But I think
even as recently as last year, the department was actively supporting it. So I don't think there was any intention to mislead people, but that was a pretty recent position, as I recall.
All right. And do we want to we've got Nicole Reynolds and Mike Barnhill. Does either one of you want to make a comment about this? I think the letter was pretty clear, but if you wanted to sort of just say anything, you're welcome to at this time. Otherwise, we'll go on to additional questions.
Madam Chair, this is Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. For the record, I don't think further comment is needed. We just wanted to clarify the record because the position of the administration is no position at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions for the bill sponsor, Representative McCarty? And then Nelson.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wool, you've continued my insomnia of reading all sorts of documentation about this. I really like it. And there's no buts. There's a however. and
you've really become a legislator now, McCarty. You've really grown into the role. It's great.
and the however is like, I'm finding that there's one entity that's thumbing their nose at us and saying we're not going to pay any taxes, and we can't even hunt them down, and we can't find out who are the people in the state that are doing their bidding of allowing their vehicles to be used. And I've talked to the revenue people, I've talked to state licensing people, I've talked to legal, and in the case of Turo, they don't even have a business license in the state. And my thought is like, well, how many other entities know this is a great, I support this, you know, piece. It's like, this is a Pandora's box of how many other entities exist that are doing this paradigm shift of business type operations through apps, and how, and this may be the question through of revenue, how do we find out who these people are, and do we have our own NSA of business, you know, to monitor, to audit, to collect the taxes? Because we're asking to do this, but how are we going to, and then is it going to involve enforcement that's going to cost the people of Alaska more money than we'll get from the collection? So there's a couple questions there. If anybody wants to answer that or give some type of clarity to it.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Co-Chair Swanholtz. And Representative McCarty, I think there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. I will focus on a couple points. That Turo didn't apply for a business license in the state of Alaska. So maybe in their mind they're not doing business in Alaska, but I know they are receiving monies from car rentals in Alaska through their hosts. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a sort of similar business, Uber, for example, Uber does have a business license, and they do pay corporate income taxes in the state of Alaska. Why? Because they earn money in the state of Alaska. So if you earn money in a state and you're a corporation, a C Corp, you have to pay taxes. Turo has stated they're going to have an IPO here in 2021. To have an IPO means you're traded on the stock market, which means you're a C Corp. And if you're a C Corp, you have to pay corporate income taxes in the state of Alaska. So maybe when that happens, there'll be a little more transparency as to what their revenues are, since they'll have to pay tax here. But as it stands right now, individuals selling fish and chips down on the boardwalk here in Juneau has a business license because they're doing business in the state of Alaska. Turo does not. So, again, this bill is going to classify these types of rental car rental companies as tax as liable to, for the state rental tax. And I use rental company, but the actual phrase peer-to-peer rental network. Anyhow, they'll be defined as those that are subject to the vehicle rental tax.
Mm-hmm. You have a follow-up?
Just a follow-up that I heard through some testimony that even the municipality of Anchorage did something regarding Turo and asking for money, so they're operating here. I received a letter from someone in the state to that acknowledged that they're a Turo business entity operating in the state, you know, under the app of Turo. They're an Alaskan, so we know they're here. Mm-hmm. It's just their thumb on their nose at us. And again, how do we collect that? And with that, yeah, this is a great bill. Do we need to make mention of this at all in there? Because it's already in statute that if you're doing business, you have to have a business license. Do we need to make mention of this more so for the Alaskans that think they don't have to get a business license because somebody else is taking care of it for them and such? I don't know, but.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, it is law and statute already. If you're doing business, have a business license. I don't think I need to repeat that in this bill, but I understand your sentiment.
All right, and back to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Commissioner Barnhill. Commissioner, Representative Field just said earlier that the Department of Revenue supported the previous iteration of this bill. Was that true last year, or what was the Department of Revenue's stance on this?
Mr. Barnhill, you might be on mute.
Through the chair, Representative, I believe the department and the administration in the previous administration, the Walker administration, supported a previous version of this. I'm not aware of the department taking a position on this bill last year. It's possible it happened. I just don't have information at my fingertips.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And next up is Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. I've been looking at this and thinking the effective date says act takes effect immediately, et cetera, under statute. And is there a... So will the people that have been renting cars through Turo have a liability of back taxes? So what, if it becomes effective, is there a grace period for implementing this? I'm just thinking with people, with what we've all gone through, that may be a hard hit if this is passed. Is there any mechanism in it to kind of hold them a little harmless or help transition? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, they currently are liable. So if they didn't pay the tax, I don't think anyone's going to try to enforce it. There's, again, they don't even know who these people are. So unless they self-report, they're if this becomes law, then when you rent a Turo, a car through Turo, there now will be a line item after the car rental, say $100, it'll say $110, with $10 being the state tax. That $10 will go to Turo. Turo will remit the $10 back to the state of Alaska. I don't believe they're going to, they still won't have all the names of all the car hosts, but so I think the answer is they won't enforce the past taxes that weren't paid because they're not doing that now anyways. So I think going forward they will just collect the tax that's remitted through Turo from the individual renting the car. Again, it's not a liability that's incurred by the car owner, it gets passed on to the person renting the car. What's happened in the past, probably the renter didn't collect, the car owner didn't collect the tax from the person renting the car, and will they go back and try to find all those people? And I don't believe so. I just think going forward they will start collecting the tax.
As a point of clarification, too, on page 4 of the bill, section 8, it says that the act takes effect immediately, so it doesn't say that it's retroactive to an earlier date. It says that it takes effect immediately. So, Mr. Barnhill, do you want to specifically comment on the administration's intent to approach this bill, on how to approach implementation of this bill?
Madam Chair, again, Mike Barnhill for the record. If the bill is passed, we'll implement it per the language of the bill.
Of the bill. All right.
Follow up.
Representative Coffin.
So, thank you. Through the chair, to Commissioner Barnhill. The implementation of this, is it anticipated we may have to litigate to get Truro to participate? I've heard that they've been a bit standoffish thus far. So the reason why I ask is, I guess I'm thinking what the discovery process would be. If we do get into litigation, there's the discovery process that creates a liability. Truro anticipates that they're going to be held liable for it. So somehow there's a cascade effect. That's a bit complicated, I appreciate. But if you can you anticipate that is a possibility or a likelihood? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, given the background of this, the litigation that prompted this particular legislation, it does seem foreseeable that litigation would continue. But I'm speculating, and I'm hesitant to speculate on what might happen, particularly with respect to a particular taxpayer. I know I'm not trying to sound facetious, but if the bill passes, we will implement it in good faith. And if there's litigation, there's litigation. If there's an efficient way of implementing it, we'll look for the efficient way of implementing it.
All right. One more. Representative Coffin.
Through the chair, thank you. I just trying to get those thoughts out there for, management of change as we are likely to change things. Thank you.
All right. And next up, we've got Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. I guess Representative McCarty's comments just prompted me to want to say I agree. We need companies to follow the law. The law is pretty clear cut here. We have an activity, renting cars. The law should apply equally whether companies do business through an app or through a storefront. I think Representative Kaufman made some good comments about this at an earlier meeting. This isn't the only issue where we're going to confront how do we adapt to an environment where we're selling a good or a service through an app, and we want to be equitable to companies, and you don't want to advantage a company because they use an app instead of for a storefront, or because they use a storefront instead of an app. The playing field should be level. The absence of a level playing field, conversely, encourages companies to engage in what economists call rent-seeking activities, and that's, you open Econ 101 and you don't want to encourage rent-seeking activities. They're inefficient. They tend to exist in an environment of political corruption. It's incumbent on us to ensure companies follow the law. So, it's pretty obvious to me, digital transactions for services and for use of property, which is what this is really a service and the use of property, can be taxed equitably. Just look at the lodging taxes that Airbnb pays. It's actually not that hard to coordinate. Airbnb works with every locality in the country where they operate in every state. To ensure that there's as level playing field as possible vis-a-vis hotels. And I think you can look at the municipality of Anchorage to see how we have hotels and Airbnbs, and they offer very similar services, and it works. And because we tax Airbnb, we get a public benefit. Because owners of property can sell or rent that property through Airbnb, they get a benefit, and that's a win-win. I guess it's just worth, you know, I want to step back and observe that over the last couple decades, the middle class has seen stagnant wages and rising costs while governments have faced growing fiscal constraints. And part of that is because we have some companies that have engaged in rent-seeking behavior. They've tried to exploit, you could say, anachronisms in the law that didn't anticipate selling a good or a service through an app. And as Representative McCarty said, our laws need to be current. I think it's pretty clear we can't solve these larger structural problems if we let outside companies flagrantly violate the law, as is the case with Turo. So the question is simple. As more services and labor brokerage migrate to digital platforms, how do we get public benefit? And I think the key is, again, a level playing field. Consumers should see the benefits of convenience through apps without sacrificing the state's fiscal position, without sacrificing wages of workers, and without sacrificing other public goods. So I think this bill is a really simple bill. It addresses one area where we've seen migration to digital services, and I think this committee should support it and signal to companies that we're going to always seek a level playing field. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to go ahead and open up public testimony. All right. First up, we're going to go to Sean Vink with Turo.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sean Vink. I'm senior counsel at Turo. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. Listening to the testimony, I just have a few comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions. As I read the bill, the basic thrust is to equate vehicle owners who engage in rental or sharing activities with traditional multinational rental car corporations. And the bill, on its in its own language, seeks to impose the same obligations and burdens on those vehicle owners that may share their car, including through an app, as would exist on traditional rental car businesses. Setting aside questions and issues I see with some of the ambiguity in what the actual impact of the language is to those vehicle rental businesses, I think what is clear is that, contrary to what some of the claims from proponents have been, this bill does not transfer obligations onto vehicle sharing platforms that don't have a physical presence in the state of Alaska. What the bill does is, on its own terms, impose collection obligations now on individuals who share vehicles through a technology platform such as Turo or perhaps others. That's not clear. So if the objective here is to try to impose certain obligations on out-of-state platforms that allow for transactions to occur digitally in order to level the playing field, that's a reasonable goal, and it's worth talking about, and certainly this legislature has the authority to engage in that discussion. The problem that I would point out, though, is that that's not really what this bill does. It simply imposes those obligations on people that exist in your state who happen to use a platform to process those transactions. So I'm not sure that the text of the bill actually accomplishes what some of the objectives that were outlined earlier are. There are other issues that I see with the bill. I will try to be brief and economical, but claims that were made about platforms that are out of state not paying their fair share, or that this bill would impose those tax obligations on platforms and get the companies to pay what is the appropriate amount. Again, the underlying tax here is a tax that is imposed on consumers. Those are people, in this case, that are sharing cars. The effect of this bill is to expand the universe of people who collect that tax from consumers. Regardless of how you view this, it has no impact to the bottom line of corporations, businesses inside of Alaska, or out-of-state platforms that may facilitate these transactions. It doesn't even purport to do that. We would suggest that there are, if the idea is to put together a comprehensive regulatory scheme for the activity of peer-to-peer car sharing, that there are a number of other items to consider, including consumer protection, public safety, and insurance. There is a national model peer-to-peer car sharing bill that has been improved by the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, and we think that a process that involves addressing all of the points that are raised by NCOIL, as well as taxation, if that is the desire of the legislature, that would be a more appropriate context to go through these issues. But as written, I'm not sure that I think that it corresponds to what the proponent's stated intent is, and I think that the primary effect is to increase the universe of individuals and small businesses that would be subject to tax collection obligations and perhaps other obligations simply because they have used a platform as a mechanism to share their car.
Mr. Bing, can I ask
so
for
I will leave
your comment
there? Thank you.
All right. Co-Chair Fields.
Mr. Vink, I have a question. Do you think if General Motors had to pay taxes and Ford did not, that would have an impact on their competitiveness vis-a-vis each other?
I assume that the answer is yes. I don't represent either of those companies and don't know what their financial situation is.
Follow-up, then obviously it would have an impact on your competitiveness vis-a-vis bona fide local businesses in Alaska that rent cars. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Bink? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess what I'm wondering, are you saying that, like, with respect to page 1, line 12B, a vehicle rental business that arranged or executed the rental through the vehicle rental network if the rental was arranged or executed through a vehicle rental network.
Rental network.
Would that be in, would the interpretation be that the rental business is the individual renting the car or the online or app driven broker that's arranging the rental?
I think it's a, if I may answer the question, yes. So, yes, I think you're highlighting the section. My interpretation of this is that the major thrust is to impose tax collection obligations now on two categories. The person who provides the leased vehicle, that's under current law, and then under this bill, it would be a vehicle rental business. That is a defined term later in the bill. There are two relevant defined terms. The first is the vehicle rental business. The second is the vehicle rental network. The vehicle rental business, my interpretation is that is the person or entity that owns the vehicle. The network is the platform through which the owner of the vehicle connects with the person that wants to share the vehicle to identify and to make that arrangement. So the vehicle network, the way it's defined, is not the same thing as the rental business. It's trying to introduce a new category. What I'm suggesting is that no obligation is put on the network. You've put the obligation, or this bill rather, puts the obligation on the business, which is the owner of the vehicle. The network and the business are not the same thing. They're separate defined terms. That's why I'm suggesting that the bill doesn't do what maybe some are suggesting that it attempts to do, and I think that that raises an issue of ambiguity and problems with the structure of this that probably would require further discussion and elaboration. I'm suggesting in the context of broader questions over peer-to-peer regulation.
Mr. Vink? The chair is going to ask a question here. Does Turo collect tax on rentals that take place in other states?
Madam Chair, yes. The answer to the question is yes. In the aftermath of the Wayfair decision of the Supreme Court, states have been authorized to apply tax collection and remittance obligations to out-of-state platforms, uh-huh. and that transfers the tax collection obligation from vendors to platforms under certain circumstances. States have to follow certain constitutional restrictions. So to that end, we are required by law and the Supreme Court decision to collect and remit sales taxes on many transactions. And I believe that the number of states is now about 24, but I, you know, don't.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have another question. Collect sales taxes. I have another question with reference to your earlier testimony. You said that this bill seeks to equate individuals who seek to rent their vehicles with multinational corporations. Is
yes.
Does Turo only rent and practice in the United States of America, or do you operate outside of the United States as well?
To be clear, my comment was that the people that are being equated with multinational rental companies are the owners of the vehicle. Turo does not own any vehicles. Turo is a technology.
Mr. Turo, sorry, Mr. Bink, you didn't answer my question. You're not answering my question.
I'm trying to answer your question. My answer is that we do operate in other countries, or we have owners in other countries, but we don't own any vehicles. And my comment earlier was to point out that this is trying to equate shared vehicle owners with multinational corporations.
All right,
which
so
we would suggest is
thank
not
you.
Correct.
You've answered my question. So Turo is a multinational corporation. Thank you. Representative McCarty.
Yes, to the chair. So the people that are doing some type of an agreement with Turo, that they are the ones that are, an Alaskan individual is collecting all the money and then sending the money to Turo? Or is Turo collecting the money and send the money to the Alaska owner of the car?
Let me, if I could ask, are you speaking to taxes? Or to
no, I'm talking about just the business of when, if I were to go onto app and I asked for a Turo car in Alaska and someone came up to me, I give them the money for the use of the car, I give them my credit card and they run it on their own machine, and then does that person from Alaska report to you, or do I do it on the app and it goes through Turo?
In our case, and other peer-to-peer car sharing programs may or may not be the same, but the person that is sharing the car provides the payment through the peer-to-peer car sharing program, and then the program remits to the vehicle owner the owner's compensation.
So I'm paying Turo for the follow-up. Yeah, I'm paying Turo for this service, and Turo is subcontracting with entities in Alaska.
What we would say is that you are paying Turo the total price of the trip, and then Turo would remit the share that is due the host for that amount.
Okay. Last follow-up. So that means that Turo is really doing business in Alaska. Thank you.
Well, there's a specific defined terms in Alaska statute on that, which we would point out do not suggest that we're doing business in Alaska, nor are the
Mr. Vink,
host agents of Turo. I'm not sure I agree.
Mr. Vink, I don't think that was a question. I think that was a comment. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Mr. Vink before we move on? We've got other invited testimony that we need to get to. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Carl Sabo with NetChoice.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Sabo. I'm Vice President and General Counsel of NetChoice. I'm also an adjunct professor at George Mason Antonin School of Law School. So a couple of things that I do want to address that were raised. First of all, the Wayfair decision did nothing to open up states to apply the taxes that are being described in this legislation. As you know, Alaska doesn't have a statewide sales tax, and the South Dakota law, of which NetChoice was one of the first litigants, was only about sales taxes, not vehicle rental taxes. They are two very, very different things. So to assume that Wayfair opened the door for a vehicle rental tax is a misinterpretation of the Supreme Court decision. And Representative Kaufman, you were referencing what about back taxes? Well, that is exactly what sank the North Dakota bill in the Supreme Court's decision in Quill, is that it had opened the door to back taxes. So if this is passed and is once again litigated, that's the exact type of thing that will sink the Alaska bill. Now, one of the comments was, it's effective immediately. So if it is not retroactive, then it can't be anything other than a new tax, so in which case you're passing a new tax. Or if it is retroactive, then it will face the same constitutional problems that North Dakota did back in 1992 under Quill. Second, no state applies the exact same rental car excise tax to peer-to-peer car sharing as they do to rental car. It's treated very differently. Not a single state treats them identically. And not a single state has passed this legislation despite Hertz and Big Rental's efforts. And I think that's because they recognize that it is a new tax. And a new tax that falls on your residents because it's their cars and trucks being taxed. Third, car sharing platforms are nothing new and nothing like rental cars. I mean, you're familiar with Hertz, Enterprise, and Avis because they're at every airport. But you haven't heard of car sharing services because they're usually just your neighbors asking each other via bulletin boards or newspaper classified ads. They are, of course, fundamentally different things. Hertz and Big Rental own thousands of vehicles in Alaska. Turo doesn't own a single vehicle. It's your citizens' cars. Hertz and Big Rental enjoy a tax carve-out of more than $4 billion nationwide and $1.9 million in Alaska. Neither Turo nor your citizens are eligible for it. In fact, they say that basically, the argument is that peer-to-peer systems have an app, provide other services, and make vehicle rentals possible via the classified section. So essentially, they are exactly the same as the Anchorage Daily News' classified page, which has an app, provides other services, and enables rentals possible. In fact, the definition of vehicle rental network would capture the Anchorage Daily News' classified page. So to the extent that you want to go after, quote-unquote, tax scofflaws, the Anchorage Daily News is one of those tax scofflaws that we are trying to take an action against under the definition of vehicle rental network. So either this is way too over-inclusive and a new tax, or it is a retroactive tax that is already on the books, in which case you don't need the bill. And if you do enact it, then it will face the same constitutional problems that North Dakota saw under Quill. I'm happy to answer any of the questions that you have, but this is literally a multi-billion dollar set of corporations that own rental cars versus a tech startup that has no physical presence and will be protected in the courts.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Co-Chair Fields.
Just a comment. It's a little ironic that this testifier is inveighing against these companies that actually operate in the state of Alaska when NetChoice is a trade group funded by Alibaba, Amazon.com, Google, eBay, and some of the other largest multinational companies on Earth. So I just can't help but note the irony.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions from
the Madam Chair, may I respond, please?
Representative Kaufman?
No, not at this time.
Thanks. All right. Thank you. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Benjamin Palmer with Enterprise Holdings. And we're going to I'm going to ask you to limit your testimony to 5 minutes because we're trying to get this. We're trying to get out of here by 5 o'clock. So.
Absolutely. No, I heard you initially, and I will absolutely do that. My name is Benjamin Palmer, Director of Government and Public Affairs for Enterprise Holdings. Really appreciate the opportunity to express our support here for HB 90. Enterprise is a privately held family-owned company with the Enterprise, Alamo, and National brands. We've been operating in Alaska since 1989. We recruit recent college graduates, find ways to give back to the community where we can, and are very happy to be here in Alaska. Again, I know you've had a robust hearing Friday as well as the discussion just now. I want to be respectful. Simply put, HB 90, it does clarify that these peer-to-peer car rental platforms are required to collect remit taxes for rentals on their platforms. And that tax is paid by the renter and something that all customers in the state of Alaska should already expect when renting a car. As stated before, it creates a level playing field and ensures the state's general fund does not lose out on revenue owed on these transactions. Again, happy to answer any questions. Want to be brief, but I know we have that 5 o'clock time coming up. But really appreciate the committee's time and work on this measure.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Palmer? Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Palmer.
Palmer. Mr. Palmer, does Enterprise do peer-to-peer services as well?
You know, we have Enterprise Car Share. I'm sorry, through the chair. we have Enterprise Car Share. We don't currently offer peer-to-peer services, but, yeah, at this point we do have Enterprise Car Share in various locations.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Is there anybody else online for public testimony? Doesn't look like it. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. All right. So, seeing no further questions, do we have a motion?
Thanks. Co-Chair Sponholz, I move House Bill 90, Work Order 32-LS0396/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? All right. Seeing no objection, HB 90 passes from committee unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Representative Wohl and Ms. Carrick. We appreciate your time today. That wraps up our business this afternoon. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, April 14th at 3:15 in Barnes 124. We're going to have informational hearings on the state of Alaska's infrastructure and on our unemployment insurance software. Thanks again to our Secretary, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Alex Banasek. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 4:51 p.m.